But it is a pleasure for me to be here this morning, but I'll have to admit to you, as he said, I just got back from Tokyo last night, so it's about 2 o'clock tomorrow morning on my biological clock, so if I have trouble connecting words, you'll know where that's coming from. But it's a pleasure for me to be here. I do take a great amount of enjoyment in visiting with cattle industry groups and have done so in my career. In particular, it is a pleasure for me to be in this particular spot. If I can get this to advance. Today, for a couple of reasons. One is I grew up about 20 miles north of here in Bottomhut County, Virginia, and spent the first part of my life showing Angus heifers. And recall with a great deal of fondness, my sister and I covering the ground on the eastern part of the U.S. back in the 1970s, trailing Angus heifers along the way. And I just wanted to start my comments here this morning by saying to you that that's a very valuable experience. And I appreciate the opportunity that I had as a kid to do that, to learn a little bit about hard work, to learn a little bit about getting your hands dirty, to learn a little bit about responsibility, and it was the wisdom of my parents to do that for us, and I really appreciate that and commend you as an association to continue to do that in the future with your junior program. Now this morning I'm going to talk to you about a pretty technical subject, and I'm going to try to do so in a way that hopefully you'll be able to think about it in ways you haven't before, necessarily, provoke you to think a little bit about how it fits into the arena that you have already developed as an association and as a breed. Sally and Bill did a very nice job, I think, in setting the stage for me today to talk about the tools that you have available to you as breeders to use to make genetic improvement. And I'll have to admit to you that as those tools develop over the last, say, 30, 35 years, that it has been amazing to me to see how rapidly you have had put into your hands the number of different pieces of information that you have to use to sort cattle now. I never dreamed 10 years ago that you would be talking today in the Angus breed through National Cattle Evaluation, through the application of computing technology that we saw that allowed us to get the EPDs 15, 20 years ago now, that you'd be talking about a list of data this long. To have 17 EPDs at your fingertips for a wide array of traits that cover the full spectrum, really, of production, and now the full spectrum going back into the inputs, as Sally and Bill talked about a moment ago, is amazing. And I would ask you as I go through my comments this morning to remember that these things will always be the center of what you do. Even with the new technology that we see coming onto line with DNA that I'll spend most of my time talking to you about this morning, that will only add to what you already have. It won't replace it. It will only add to it. So critical to you is to continue using this great technology that you've developed and to continue to grow it as you are currently doing. Now I want to spend the first 20-25 minutes of my time with you covering for you where we have come in this DNA technology. And I hope I will do it in a way that will describe for you, number one, how difficult it is to develop it, the science that has to go into the background of developing a DNA test, if you will, that goes onto the market for the industry. And number two, then come back and talk to you about what we have to do with that technology once we have released it to the field. So once we have tests out in the marketplace, as we're currently seeing happen now, what are the steps that we have to take to incorporate the information from those tests into the greater scheme of genetic evaluation that we already have? Roughly 40 years ago, 50 years ago now, I guess, We established in the scientific fields that the genetic code was carried in the form of DNA. Francis Crick and James Watson, the scientists that published that information in 1953, now one of the landmarks in science, never dreamed that it would take 50 years for us to be able to begin to unravel that at the laboratory level. We knew what the structure was. We knew it was a double helix. We knew there were these components of that double helix that carried the factors called genes. But what we didn't know was how to visualize it. We didn't know how we would be able to see it and score it and look at it on an individual animal basis. We now, over the last particularly 15 years, have begun to be able to do that. So I want to walk through that history a little bit with you first, then talk a little bit about the tests that we have on the market, and then talk a little bit about where we go from here. DNA, as Watson and Crick said, is a double helical structure. It contains all of the genes that are important for us that impact these traits. I will ask you to remember as I go through these next slides that all of the traits that we're dealing with that you're interested in, for the most part, with the exception of very few, are traits that are controlled by many, many different genes. We don't talk about marbling, as an example, being a trait that is controlled by a gene, or even a few genes. We talk about it being a trait that we know through well-established theory that is controlled by many different genes. We don't even know how many at this point. We're even speculating how many of those genes there might be. So when we're talking about DNA here, remember when we get to the level of talking about a gene, we're talking about a gene that is one of many that impact these economically important traits. DNA is a complex system. There are over 3 billion pieces of information in the average mammalian genome, where the genome is the full genetic makeup of that individual, all of the DNA for that individual. In cattle, the genome is made up of 30 pair of chromosomes. The DNA is split into pieces called chromosomes. Within each of those chromosomes reside the genes. A piece of a chromosome would be a gene that would code for something important in the body, would create a protein from it that is important in some physiological way in the body. Up until just a few years ago, when the human genome was sequenced, we thought that there were well over 100,000 genes that would be present in the genome of mammals. What we know now from the Human Genome Project is our best estimate is there are far fewer genes than what we originally thought. You see there on this slide that there are some 30,000 to 40,000 genes that have been estimated to be present in the human genome. We believe the same will be true in the cow and livestock species. So many of these genes have multiple functions, may even encode multiple proteins in the way that they're regulated at the genome level. Back up. There are several steps that we have to take in genomics research to get to the point where we have identified a place in the genome, a place in the DNA, that has a particular gene that's of importance for us to study and then to use. It is a very laborious process. I won't be able to emphasize that enough to you. We started in the research arena in the late 1980s due to the developments that had happened at the laboratory level that would allow us to visualize DNA. I won't go into the technical details of that this morning with you, but there were a couple of major things that happened in the late 1980s that allowed us to move into this. Remember Watson and Crick, 1953, 1985 to 1990, sometime period later we were able to finally start doing that. That allowed us then to start the whole field of what we call gene mapping. You heard a lot about this during the 1990s. There were several projects that were started in the early 1990s, one at Texas A&M, one with USDA at the Meat Animal Research Center, one in Australia, another in Canada, several in Europe, that were seeking to identify locations within the genome across these 30 cattle chromosomes that had locations we could visualize for genotype, say what the alleles were that the animal carried for that particular chromosomal location. From that, we could develop so-called linkage maps of the genome and then start to look for regions of these chromosomes using those genotypes that would tell us they were important in affecting economically important traits. Problem with that was we then also had to identify what those locations were in terms of the genes that affected them. So as I walk through the next several slides, I'm going to give you some examples of what it has taken to do that. I just, as I mentioned, returned from Tokyo. I was at an international genetics meeting there where the genetics community comes together once every 2 years to review their science. And at that meeting, they talked about how the cattle map now has over 9,000 locations mapped within that genome. I can remember in 1994, when the first maps were published, that number was something around 400 to 500 markers. So we've come a tremendous distance in the amount of information that we actually have placed on the cattle genome in terms of places that we know the sequence. Pigs and chickens and other livestock species have likewise come a far way. What you see on the right-hand side of this slide is a particular cattle chromosome. In this case, it's cattle chromosome 12, the 12th of the 30 chromosomes. And each of those locations that is a little hard to see is a particular location on that chromosome that has been identified, has been mapped, that we know how we can visualize and genotype that particular location on that chromosome. And if you total all 30 up, we have some 9,000 now of those locations. Using these linkage maps then, again beginning in the early 1990s, scientists were able to develop research populations to start trying to see if they could identify particular ones of those markers, of those locations in the genome, that seemed to be located next to a gene of interest affecting the trait. So-called marker association studies, where the result of this, or the intent, was to identify what are called QTLs. You may have seen that or heard that in the popular press. It stands for quantitative trait locus. All it means is there's a gene there that's impacting a trait. It's a location or a locus in the genome that seems to be impacting a trait of importance. And the way they did that was they formed populations that would allow them to have animals in those populations that would be expected to be very heterozygous for these genes and for these markers, so that when they were bred out in designed breeding systems, they would segregate different forms of these genotypes, different alleles, to their progeny, where you could then evaluate the progeny that contained one of those alleles, like on the left-hand side of this chart, as compared to progeny that would have an alternate form of that allele. So you'd be able to describe this difference in populations that possess one form of the genotype versus another. A lot of that work was done at Clay Center, at the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center, where they formed families like this one, where they took widely divergently different breeds, in this case Piedmontese and Angus, crossed them into F1s. Those F1s then are the segregating population that I've just described to you. You'd expect them to be highly heterozygous for traits of importance. And then you would breed them back in repeated back crosses to form progeny families that would be segregating these different alleles that you could then genotype and pick up. They measured a tremendous number of traits. This is a list of the Clay Center project, the traits they were storing on all of these offspring of, in their case, five different resource families like the one I just showed you, to see if they could pick up locations of the chromosomes harboring these QTL, or quantitative trait loci. And as a result of that, by the late 1990s, we had around the world, through several projects, this being one of them, identified a number of QTL for different traits on different chromosomal locations of importance. What this slide shows you, just to explain the cartoon to you, each of those little bars represents a chromosome within the genome. And you'll notice there's not all 30 of them there. They're the ones that have the most important QTL shown in the diagram. And each of those locations where there's an acronym beside the bar represents a gene, a QTL that has been identified through this linkage mapping process for a particular trait. For example, you see there on the second one from the left, the top, you see MARB. There's a marbling QTL at that location
on, in that particular case, chromosome 2 of the cow. Total in this project of 27 different QPLs had been identified that were of importance for these traits. So it worked. We were able to identify a number of QPLs for different traits through this process. And likewise, others in the world did that in other research programs as well. Problem is that once you have identified these, you still aren't to the end of the road. You don't know what the gene is that's laying there on that chromosome. You don't know what it's producing that's causing that effect. You don't know how it's being regulated by potentially other genes in the genome, where we know much of the action, to put it lightly, really is. So you have to go back in other populations, look at these, validate these, see how they're working, and go through a whole host of other steps in the project to get to that point of full understanding. It's what we call fine mapping of a gene. So even though you have, to that point, identified that you've got a location on one of these chromosomes that has a gene of importance, you don't know down at the DNA level what the code for that gene is, what the differences in that gene are that are causing the difference in the performance that you see. So that's another process of steps to go through to do that. Fortunately, we have had the power of what's called comparative mapping available to us. You know, a lot of people have wondered about the impact of the Human Genome Project. You've seen that in the paper on a readily often basis the last couple of years as they sequenced the human genome, $3 billion project roughly over the course of its history. That was finished about a year and a half ago. That project has really spearheaded us forward because the human genome is very homologous to or comparative to or close to, however you want to describe it, most other mammalian genomes, including the cow. Most of the locations you can identify in the human genome, you can find them in the cattle genome. And you can find them regularly with about 85 to 90% complete similarity in DNA sequence. So that's a very valuable tool for us. We can take the fact that if we know, for instance, in the middle of this slide, this is a cartoon picture of human chromosome 11, that particular location in the human genome. These blue bars on the left refer to locations in the cattle chromosome. See this blue bar there? That's part of human 11. Is on chromosome 15 of the cow. And this chunk here, this red chunk, is from chromosome 29 of the cow. So by knowing these comparative regions of the human genome, we can actually translate the tremendous amount of information we know on the human genome, where we know the entire sequence, and we know many of the genes, and we know many of their functions, over to these livestock species in a fairly simplistic fashion. And we've done that with some regularity now. For example, this is a great example. It's one that defies the principle what I told you earlier. It is actually a single gene trait that is controlled by a single gene, but provides a beautiful example of the power of comparative mapping. Double muscling in cattle. This is a gene that had been of interest to the Europeans for a long time because they use double muscling in their production systems, especially the Belgian blue. And Belgium is used on a routine basis in that industry, and they wanted to understand what the genetic inheritance of it was. Comparative mapping unraveled that fairly quickly in the 1990s. A scientist named Michel Georges in Belgium, used to be at Genmark here in the States in the late 1980s, had been working on this his entire career, trying to understand the inheritance pattern of double muscling. Well, by the mid-1990s, he and a number of other scientists had identified that on chromosome 2 of the cow, there were markers, back to my previous example, the linkage mapping and finding of QTLs, there were markers in this region of chromosome 2 that seemed to control double muscling, seemed to cause the inheritance of that condition. About the same time they had localized this to this region, along with some workers at Clay Center as well, they picked up a magazine one day, one of the scientific magazines, and on the cover of the magazine was a double-muscled mouse. Now, literally, a double-muscled mouse. A big mouse and a little mouse. One that was double-muscled and one that wasn't.
where in the human genome, they had identified that a gene called myostatin, located on a particular human chromosome, that lo and behold, mapped to chromosome 2 of the cow, using comparative mapping just like I told you a minute ago, that caused double muscling in this mouse. So if you inactivated myostatin, if you had a form of that gene that caused that protein to be inactive in the body, mice will double muscle. Well, it did not take long for Michelle and his colleagues in Belgium to figure out that that likely described double muscling in cattle. They then went heavily into that region of chromosome 2, started sequencing that region of the chromosome, found the myostatin gene in that process for cattle by comparing the sequence to human, and they identified at one location in that gene, 313 codons or protein reading segments into that gene, there was a single base switch from G, guanine, to A, adenine, that caused this effect. So Piedmontese cattle, double muscle, because they have the alternate form of the gene, causing a different amino acid to be put into that protein chain for myostatin, which causes it to be inactive in the system. The result is those cattle are double muscle. Beautiful example of the power of comparative mapping, where the human genome has brought back and told us something about the cattle genome. Now, to some examples in cattle for the breeding world here. One of the things I told you was that just because we identify lots of regions of these chromosomes that contain QTLs, we have a lot of steps to take further than beyond that to get to tests for the industry. A number of years ago, now late 1980s, Jan Lyons is in the audience from NCBA, the Beef Checkoff funded a large project at Texas A&M to identify QTLs for carcass traits. And from that project, they identified by the mid-1990s that there were 10 to 11 QTLs that seemed to be of importance for various traits, from tenderness through retail yield, fatness, growth, number of different characteristics. Problem was they had to validate whether that was going to work industry-wide or not, because those had been identified in Brahman Angus resource families, like I described to you for Floyd Center, in their case Brahman Angus, and they needed to see if those would hold up. So in 1998, there was a large-scale project initiated, again, by the Checkoff, to validate these QTLs and see if they would work. It's called the National Carcass Merit Project. Just recently finished that project. They've now released that. These are actually pulled from the report. It's on the web. You can go to the NCBA website and find that there. But I want to point out to you a couple of things from that project that are very telling. There were 11 QTLs identified in the original Texas A&M work, marked here as Q1 through Q11. So regions of chromosomes that impacted various traits in that project that they wanted to study. When they looked at these QTLs now across a wide array of breeds, 14 breeds in the Carcass Merit Project, 50 progeny per each of 10 sires required to participate in the project, they found that there were several of these QTLs, highlighted here by the red, that did impact, if you see a red value there, it means they significantly impacted performance in that trait. So when you genotype this QTL in these populations, they seem to have an important and significant effect on variation in that trait. For instance, QTL6 and QTL8, the two that you see routinely, have impact over a number of these traits, significantly important predictors of tenderness, if you will. So there seems to be a gene in those regions of those two chromosomes that impact tenderness in an important way. Other take-home message here is there were 11 of these. And if you just sort through, you'll see that not every one of them validated to be of importance across all the breeds in the study. So there will be some sifting, some wheat from the chaff, so sifting the chaff out of the process as we go through these validations in the future. The other important take-home message from that study is that each of these QTLs are only going to identify a small proportion of the variation that you see in one of these traits. Remember what I said earlier, multiple genes affecting a trait. Lots of genes. So a QTL here is going to be one of those, or at the most a very few of those genes that are impacting it.
Look at QTL6. Remember that important one I just showed you a moment ago, affecting tenderness and shear force? Right here. Controlling about 10 to 15% of the variation in that trait.
Okay?
But if you look across all of these QTLs, what you see, and you generalize those results, typically we'll expect important QTLs to control somewhere between 5 and 8%
of the variation that we'll see in one of these traits at the level of the animal where you're evaluating these phenotypes. So lots of other information beyond these that we also need to know is the take-home message.
The last thing that we have to do in all of these studies, and they did it in this one, is look at what the correlated effects will be by selecting upon a particular QTL or gene.
You know, Sally talked very eloquently a minute ago about multi-trait, looking at multi-trait importance through indexes.
If we go too far down the road with anyone given one of these genes, we stand the risk of overdoing it in a number of other areas, if there are correlated effects of a gene upon other traits in addition to the one that we're measuring it for. So if we're measuring the marbling gene, does it have impact on maternal ability of cows, on reproductive fitness, on all of the other plethora of traits that we're interested in as well? We need to keep that in mind.
So where are we? We have invested now some 15 to 18 years in this process I just described for you. Going through mapping projects, identifying QTLs, trying to move those QTLs to a validated fashion and so forth. So what do we have on the marketplace? These are the genes that have been identified in those projects that have moved to that level or are very close to moving to that level. And most of them you're pretty familiar with already. I see Tom Cora has a booth out in the hall here today that describes for you the top three of these. The GeneStar marbling test, the GeneStar Tenderness 1 and Tenderness 2 test that they just released through Genetic Solutions from Australia, Bovigen here in the U.S. Those being genes that influence purpose traits. And if you remember that slide I showed you from Clay Center, the emphasis in all of that early research work had been on end product and carcass quality traits. Thyroglobulin, in the GeneStar marbling case, is a gene that's involved with a precursor of thyroid hormone. A polymorphism or difference in that gene is what's being detected in this test. And as the literature will show you, it describes very similar levels to the proportion of variation in marbling I just showed you from the Carcass Merit Project, 8 to 12% levels of variation in that trait. Calpastatin, we've heard a lot about that now for about 15 years, an inhibitor of postmortem proteolysis, breakdown of muscle tissue as an indicator of tenderness. Cattle that tend to be tougher tend to have higher levels of calpastatin activity. That gene also now has a test on the market developed by the Australians. Calpain is the protein that calpastatin inhibits. So also involved in postmortem proteolysis. If calpain is very active, you get more proteolysis and more tender product. Calpastatin actually inhibits it, is an inhibitor of it. So those three have been worked very intensively on over the last decade to get those tests on the market. The last list of genes on this slide are newer ones. Leptin is a gene that's now being commercialized by Mariel through their new product line called Igenity, where they are taking a single nucleotide test for the leptin gene that's essentially an appetite regulator gene. It's the fat gene you heard a lot about several years ago, where if you have a particular form of the leptin gene, you eat more and you get fatter. So you expect all of the correlated effects from that. Higher fat product, higher intake. They're very interested in dairy cattle in this product, because if they can get cattle to eat more for high-producing dairy cows, they'll be able to express more of their genetic potential beyond what they're doing today. Intake is a major problem there. This is a good example of a test that is being released, but I would wonder if we've got enough data for it to be released yet. So there's a variation in the amount of data that's being presented with these tests along the way. DGAT is a test developed by Michelle Georges, the same scientist that I mentioned earlier in double muscling in Belgium. influences fat deposition in milk. A lot of interest in the dairy industry in using this gene. It's a gene called diacylglycerol transferase that codes for that protein. The last two are genes that are in the development stage. First one is somatostatin, which is a regulator of growth hormone at the level of the hypothalamus in the brain. It seems to have an impact on marbling. I suspect in the next 12 to 18 months, we'll see commercial efforts to develop that test for somatostatin hit the market. And one of the things I heard about in Japan 2 days ago that seemed very promising to me was work in Australia by the same group that developed the GeneStar marbling test for a gene called the retinoid something or another receptor. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. But they call the ROCR gene that seems to have also a significant impact on marbling. So another test that will add to the GeneStar marbling test if they can get it further developed. Now I want to spend the last amount of time I've got just pointing out to you some things that you should expect beyond where we are today and some things you should worry about a little bit. That you should worry about your strategy of where you're going to go as an association of individual breeders to use this information that's coming at you. No doubt about it that this has been, as I pointed out earlier, a laborious process. 1987 to 2004 is a long time to get to the list of genes that I just showed you. With, I won't tell you how many hundreds of millions of dollars of research that has gone into the development of those genes. It's very expensive, it's very time consuming because we haven't had the tools necessarily that the human people have had at our fingertips to develop it. So there was quite a bit of recognition the last 2 or 3 years that as the human genome was sequenced and as it became available in the public, primarily for the pharmaceutical industries to use, that the same thing needed to happen in the cattle industry, in the swine industry, in the chicken industry to move the livestock industries forward. And fortunately, we have seen that happen. We've seen a move toward wanting to understand the genome sequence of the cow. 10 years ago, I would have told you as a scientist, I never dreamed it would happen. Didn't think we'd ever see the opportunity to get to the individual base by base by base sequence level information of the cow to allow us to move this field forward much quicker. Having trouble getting it advanced. We have now moved into that project through the National Institutes of Health, the science giant, if you will, in the U.S. government that was responsible for the Human Genome Project. Now, I'm going to show you in a minute that they're paying for most of this. The National Institutes of Health is actually paying for most of the sequencing of the bovine genome, as they have done for the chicken genome as well. And you might wonder, why in the hell would they want to do that? Quite frankly, why would the human genome research community want to spend money to pay a lot of dollars, in this case over $50 million, to sequence the bovine genome? The reason is, if you go back to what I showed you about comparative mapping, it will help them a tremendous deal as well. As we identify things due to the phenotypes that we actually have amassed and collected, we have a lot of phenotypic information in the livestock industries, much more than the human medical community has. They will be able to leverage that and work backwards into the human. So, fortunately, in December of 2003, we launched the sequencing of the bovine genome. It's actually being done at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Due to several countries around the world and several funding agencies deciding this was of high priority and importance to move this field forward, you see Australia, New Zealand, and Canada involved in some funding they put forward for the project, as well as significant funding that's been put forward by the U.S. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the primary contributor to that is actually NIH. The National Institutes of Health are funding roughly half of that project. The Beef Checkoff is also a strong supporter of this work. We've been very pleased by that, for the industry to be supporting this effort as well. The projected date when this will be done, actually next week, or first of the following week, we'll release the first draft of the sequence. It was started in December, as I told you a minute ago.
They're releasing the first draft of it in September 27th, I believe is the date, where the final product with all of the holes finished and filled in will be available about a year from now. So relatively rapidly, we've been able to move forward and get the full sequence of bovine genome done. I just reiterate that. This picture actually shows the cow that's being sequenced. You take an animal's DNA and you sequence that animal's DNA. This actually is an inbred Hereford animal from the USDA Research Station in Miles City, Montana, line 1 Hereford. Only reason it's a Hereford and the only reason it's from Miles City is that this is a highly inbred cow, and it's much easier for us to sequence DNA that is much more homozygous than would you expect to be less heterozygous. So we're using that individual because she happens to be highly inbred. All right, I'm going to use the last few minutes I've got to just point out to you some concerns I've got about this field in the future. And some things that I think you need to carefully weigh, particularly those of you in leadership positions within the association, about how you capitalize on this information, how you make use of it in the future. And hopefully some of that will trickle down to you as individual breeders as well. I didn't think this would be a reality, but I do believe it firmly now. I'll just ask you, how many times have you been at meetings in the last 10 years where DNA has been pumped up to you? You've been talked about, you've been told about it, it's a wonderful new technology, and it's going to solve all the world's problems. You've been to several, I've been to several. And most of the time when you ask the hard question back to the presenter of how long is it going to be before I use this to do A, B, C, and D in my breeding program, the standard answer has been, well, in about 5 years. Mark Gardner, is that fair? In about 5 years, we'll have this technology worked out. Hopefully, by what I showed you this morning, it's more complicated than that. I hope you get the take-home message of that it's more complicated than that, and it will take a long time for this to evolve and mature as a technology that you can use to do that. But I do fully expect, just like I never thought that the bovine genome would be sequenced, and now it's being sequenced, I was proven wrong on that. I think we will see things like this in our lifetime, for sure. In the next generation of technology, where this is a chip. There are 96 wells on this chip. Each of the wells in that chip contain a particular gene of interest that you can then measure in a single reaction on robotic machinery to tell you what the genotype is on a 96-well plate, where given sections of that plate may deal with genes that are important for different things, different characteristics of performance. And to me, that will be a tremendously valuable tool. I think you can all begin to see how you would use that and how you'd be able to do it if it's presented to you in a cost-efficient manner. Mostly, even beyond the genetics that we're all interested in this room, what that has the real value to do is if you can genotype these animals for these a whole variety of genes, and then you now have a proxy, if you will, to know how to best manage those genotypes. That's where the real value is. If we know what these genotypes are, how do we best tailor the management systems to the genotypes in order to not mess them up? How to best use them in the system? But there's a lot of things that we have to do to be able to take technology like that and simplify it. I have no doubt today when I talk to you at lunch that there will be a number of you that will say that this will be a standard line. And I fully appreciate this line. I'm not meaning to say I don't. That will say to me, I really enjoyed what you were talking about, but I understood about a third of it. And I fully appreciate that. I really do. I'm not saying that in a critical way. I understand how hard it is to understand. I had to learn this stuff too. I was not trained in it. I had to learn it the last few years. And it is extremely complex. And it's hard to talk about. And we don't have a very good way of communicating it, Sally and Bill, to know how to use it in the industry. We've got to have a way to do that. We've got to simplify it somehow. And one of the ways we're going to have to simplify it is we're going to have to combine it with what we already have. We have very valuable EPD tools. And you as an association and as breeders have invested a pile of money in development. No doubt in my mind, Johnny. I'd hate to know what the total dollar figure is that people have invested in getting you to the point where you are in genetic evaluation. That will be the basis for what you put this DNA stuff over top of. It won't replace it. Even in its most complicated and great form. If that little chip I showed you a minute ago comes to reality, and you have several different ones of those you can utilize, you still have to take that information and boil it down into something you're going to use in your hands and select and bulls and females. And your customers are going to use to sort those bulls and females. Right? So we've got to have a way to do that. That is a field that we're just now beginning to implement. A few years ago, I can remember 7, 8 years ago, Sally, there was a lot of discussion in our field of genetics about concern that there weren't very many of the EPD guys left. As universities replaced researchers who retired, there weren't very many quantitative geneticists who worked with data like this left, and there aren't very many. But frankly, there are only a few of them in the country because everybody got replaced with a molecular geneticist. It was the trendy thing in the future for research. Now, guess who the most valuable person is to me in this system? The most valuable person to me is somebody who's going to be able to take this situation that we have where all animals are not going to have genotypes for these markers. There's going to be a lot of missing data in this system. And it's the problem there that maybe not all of the data that's out there will get reported. If you have a negative genotype, you're going to turn it in. So if you have a sensitive data problem, how do you take all of that together and incorporate that information into a usable product in EPAs? It's a significant problem that we've got to address in the industry. Here's an example of that. These are results from a project, again, at Clay Center by Mark Coleman, there, one of our researchers, who took a population that we've used to develop QPL. It's a population that's been selected heavily for twinning rate, see if we can improve reproductive rate in beef cattle. It's been going since the early 1980s. And they calculate EPDs for twinning rate in that population. So what you see here is four animals who have their EPD value that is calculated for twinning rate, higher is better here, in that population. And you see there that the top animal here is the second one. You start sorting them, you start applying your EPD logic to these numbers. But there also were several QTLs for twinning rate in this population. And they genotyped those QTLs in this population. There's one on chromosome 5, there's one on 7, and there's another one on 7. And when they add that information to the EPD evaluation, in the best science they have to do that at this point, guess what happens? They rerun it. And we get a little different sorting of the genotypes, if you will, from using both the EPD information and the DNA information. Take-home message, dangerous to rely on either one alone. Right? Take-home message is you need to use all of the information you have. We're a ways away from being able to do that, Sally. We've got some work that we need to do to get there. So eventually, one of these days, this is what we hope to do. Take the EPDs we're already doing with block technology, identify these QTLs and genes, add that to this bottom line of the system to what we already have in the top line for our production of EPDs. Marker-adjusted EPDs, if you will. Same way of saying that, that we have our scientists working on now. Now, I want to close with just a few comments about sustainability, and I'm going to refer to this in a couple of different ways. This is a good friend of mine, some of you know him, Donald Brown from Texas, and his young son, Lanham. How is Lanham going to use this technology? What's going to be sustainable to him when he's in Donald's shoes managing that operation, or hopefully for Donald it will be? How are we going to get there? Well, first of all, everything I presented to you this morning dealt primarily with carcass traits. Sally and Bill talked to you about moving to other traits, you know, evaluating through your EPD system, additional traits and input traits. Where the real push will come in genomics, I have absolutely no doubt about it, in terms of the funding that's going to be put forward to establish these tools and use the genome sequence we're developing, is not in carcass traits. It's going to be in the input traits. right here. Things that we really have a hard time measuring. Are there animals that are more efficient with less feed? Are there lower input costs that will allow us to capitalize in areas and tweak the system to use those? Can we increase reproductive rate? There's a threshold to that, certainly. But can we do that? Are there animal health factors that we really can start to tease out of the system, if you will, through this genomics technology? That's where the future really lies in developing these new tests, what I call peace of mind traits. Things that will give us peace of mind, not production traits necessarily, not more is better, but things that will give us peace of mind and sustainability in the system. For example, I can tell you that most of our emphasis in talking about research priorities in the program I manage is here. Can there be genetic tests that we develop for BSE resistance? Can there be genetic tests that we develop for BRD, an endemic problem in our industry that causes us, who knows, how many losses of dollars every year in the business? Can we develop new vaccines and have new drug targets through identifying these genes that impact these traits, and then we know how to best trigger them to do their job better and regulate them? Fescue toxicosis, good example. In this part of the world and through the transition zone part of the U.S., is there a way we can make use of the resources we have without worrying about what we're going to do to change fescue? Because most likely that's not going to happen in this part of the world. So, yeah, I think you get the general idea of where we're moving forward. U.S. Animal Identification Program, you heard Neil Hammersmith talk about this morning. You've heard a lot about it the last 18 months in particular. Is there a way in the future that we'll use DNA in the system? I suspect that we will see that happen one day, where that's the most efficient technology for us to use to genotype animals and at the same time collect some performance information on them or some additional genetic information. Very controversial for us to think about that, but I suspect we'll be talking about it a lot in the future. And the last thing I wanted to say before closing is that the business models in this industry still are sorting out. A number of you remember the last few years there have been several ventures that have been put forward and started in the genetics business. I was part of one of them. Genomic FX was a genetics company that was started and got out of the gate and went a little distance and then stopped. So there are several different business models that are out there trying to capitalize on and use this technology. And this is a very, very interesting time in this business. And this slide describes it very well for you. We have essentially three different business models and DNA companies operating at the moment. We have this business model at the top, which is what's known as NMI Genomics, Metamorphics, that went down the road several years ago. They used to be called Celera Genomics. Before that, they were PerkinElmer AgGen. If you remember the Linkage Genetics way back, I mean, it's that line. They went down the road a couple of years ago in doing some sequencing of the bovine and swine genomes themselves at a very light level, about a fifth the level we're talking about in the larger public project now. So they have some intellectual property that they're developing tools from to measure genotypes for some of these traits. And they want to capitalize on and close and put in the private domain that intellectual property. So they have licensed it through a large agreement with Cargill and Excel through their Caprock Feeders program on the cattle side, and most recently, just in the last few months, with Monsanto on the pig side through their swine genomics investment. So what they've done is they've tied up the IP within these large integrated companies, so to speak. That won't ever be on the public domain. It'll be in the private domain. So that's one business model. The other business models you see out there are this one, that you're probably more familiar with than any of the others, the GeneStar tests that I referred to earlier, where they are taking IP, intellectual property, developed in the public sector. The test that Genetic Solutions in Australia first marketed, GeneStar Marblin, was developed in the public sector. It was developed by the USDA of Australia, CSRO, is their form of USDA there. And they're commercializing that for sale in the industry. So they're a service provider, if you will,
They're taking that intellectual property and they're providing it as a service provider to the industries. Then you have another business model here. I mentioned Lepton earlier in my talk. Identity and Mariel, their brand name now for that product, where you have an animal health company that is getting into the genomics business, and guess why they're doing that? They aren't doing it because they want to sell genetic tests. They're doing it because they want to get in your backyard. And they want to sell you a lot of other stuff. Right? So their genetic tests, perhaps, are a loss leader. You know, it's a loss leader concept for them so that they can get in and consult you on a variety of the other products that they already have on the market, if you will. So there's three very distinctly different business models here. Then you have the same kind of things happening on the pig side. This is very similar to what's happening over here where PIC has internalized their intellectual property. They're doing their own gene discovery within their own lines, and they'll keep that in the private domain. GeneSeq down here is a company that's providing services of genotyping based in Nebraska, where they're just genotyping tests as well for researchers for the public domain. Last slide I'll show you, because I'm on zero, Sally, is that the other thing you have to sort out is what's sustainable in terms of cost to a breeder. This is the piece of the web page for the GeneStar tests. Many of you would be familiar with it. Probably many of you have used these tests already, where their pricing structure depends on how many tests you send in and how many of the genotypes you want and whether you're doing tenderness and marbling or just tenderness. So a variety of different pricing structures that you have here. Remember what I told you about sequencing the genome and the identification of stuff that's coming at us? What if we got 40 of these that are important? How are we going to pay for it? What's the pricing structure going to be? So to be sustainable, we're going to have to figure out a lot beyond where we are currently to make it affordable for the industries to utilize on a wide enough basis to give the data that Bill and Sally need to make it work in the full picture. So with that, I will close. I appreciate again the opportunity to be with you. I hope I've given you some information and food for thought. Thank you very much.